Welcome to the Show Up Podcast, a place where we explore leadership and how it's showing up for us in the world in which we work, and a space for you to explore what leadership means in your context, how you show up, how you turn up to be the best leader you can be in the world that you work in today. Welcome, everybody, to another, what hopefully will be a great episode of the Show Up Podcast with me, Graham, and my co-host, Derry, who's not going to say anything, and Jamie, who's morning. Also probably
oh,
not.
Oh, he didn't say something. I totally missed the pregnant pause there.
No, that's, good morning, everybody. That's fine. Morning, morning. Yeah. We're doing this slightly differently.
I thought you'd forgotten Jamie's name for a minute.
Easily done.
What a way to start.
So no, the reason why I'm speaking now and then I'm going to go silent for the rest of the episode is because we have a guest who I know very, very well. The chap is called David Watson. Say hello, David.
Wasn't sure if we wanted a pregnant pause there as well.
No,
hello,
that's
everybody.
Fine, that's fine,
it's
fine,
great yeah. to be here with you, gents.
Dave's a prisoner from a foreign island. No, he's not a prisoner from a foreign island. No, Dave is a colleague, friend. I've known Dave for a very long time in the space of leadership, but also what it takes to stretch people to their absolute limit in service of them growing themselves. And as I hope we'll get into in the podcast today, you'll hear why Dave's experience and what he's getting involved in the near future is going to be just something really special for this world. So on that bombshell, I'm going to retreat behind the camera, let the three chaps have a great conversation, and then you may hear my voice back on the call later on. Over to you, boys.
Thank you very much, Graham. Welcome, Dave. Awesome to meet you. Looking forward to our conversation here. I just thought people may not know much about your background, etc. It'd be great to just hear a whistle-stop tour of how you've got to where you are now. And then particularly, I love the question, what's got you excited at the moment? Like what's really kind of got your juices flowing? It'd be great to just hear a bit about that. And then we'll dive into talking about leadership in that context.
Yeah. I get excited about a lot of things. I'm excited to be here with you guys.
That's
true.
That's it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, every day is full of something amazing to look forward to. I think whistle-stop tour. I work in sports. I work for a global company called Spartan. We're an endurance sports brand in about 40, 50 countries, depending on which year you look at what we're doing. I'm currently the vice president of innovation there. So my job is working with the CEO and working with the team on, you know, growing our events all around the world. They're endurance sports events, so obstacle course racing, trail running, mountain biking, things like that. And you know, I've been there for about 8 years. Job's taken me all around the world. I've met an incredible community of all sorts of different people, and it was sort of a job I didn't expect to fall into, I guess. Before that, I was in financial technology, but I didn't expect to be in that either. because before that, I was with an NGO, which you may know, WWF, which is not the wrestling brand. As so many people ask me if I work with Kurt Angle or Hulk Hogan, and they kind of suggested maybe how old I am if I'm naming those wrestlers, but they're the best. No, the World Wildlife Fund. So I was with them. All sorts of things. I spent about 15 years in the movie business, and I ran a company in China for a while in tech, which obviously came full circle when I went back to tech, and and a few other things.
Hold on a minute. We've got 15 years in the movie business. We've got the World Wildlife Fund. We've got financial tech. We've got China. And then 8 years at Spartan, right? You don't look like you're 83. How have you?
How old am I? I'm 41. Sometimes I forget. You see, now I'm 41. I turned 42 this year. So it's funny. Someone said to me the other day, I had a lunch with somebody, and she was asking me about, you know, my career, you know, what kind of things I've done, and I said something or other. Listed a few of those things, and she said, "Are you ADHD?" I said, "I don't think so, but I can understand the question." No, I think it goes back to your point in the beginning. You know, like I tend to do things I'm excited about, you know, and when I stop being excited about something, I look for something else. You know, and I think that, I mean, I'm sure we'll get into this if when we start talking about leadership and things like that. But, you know, I think you've got to, we don't have to do anything, but I think it's important to see life as a series of experiences, because really that's all we've got. In the end, we have nothing. Well, it depends on which viewpoint you take. You might have something, but, you know, as far as I'm concerned, at least in this life, this is it. So the series of experiences we have, I think, is the most important thing. And that's what I've always chased.
That's really interesting. We had a past guest on, Ian Hallett, who described his leadership journey in the corporate world as a series of opportunities to be involved in something where you make a difference. And you've got a finite number, not very many of those in your lifetime. And I can hear in your story that you've jumped from opportunity to opportunity to have an experience and make a difference, right?
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes I think it's not always possible to make the sort of difference that we see, at least in the media, or that we're told matters, you know. Some days they're really small differences, but they are differences. And it can be to us, you know, in our own lives, or from our own, in our own lives, or, you know, in our own perspectives. You know, some days, you know what it's like. You get your laptop out, and, you know, perhaps the day's project is doing something, you know, grinding on a spreadsheet, or, you know, having a series of meetings as a passive participant on that particular day, because that particular day just doesn't really involve you in a leadership level, even if you're a leader. You know, I'm sure we can all name these sorts of things we do day to day, and everybody listening could name something today they're probably doing like that. But I think when we step back and look at it as a cumulative set of experiences, then yeah, you can really start to say, does it make a difference? But I wouldn't place unnecessary emphasis, or maybe even emphasis on the goal of doing something that makes a difference, because that's relative to, you know, the person who does it, right? And, you know, everybody has a different perspective about what makes a difference. You know, like to a, I could really get carried away here, I hope you don't mind. You know, to somebody I would meet out on the steppe of Mongolia, living in near the Siberian border, they make a great difference to the animals that they herd and to their family by being able to keep those animals alive through the winter. You know, or a publicly elected official might make a big difference to, you know, the greater city of London, for example. And they're two very different things, but they both make a difference. So I think there's a lot to unpack there.
Just to, in terms of
totally agree. Sorry, Jamie.
The comparatives of, you know, we talked about Ian Hallett, and he had a very, what you call a traditional, more linear career path. I'd describe yours more of a pinball wizard. You've got excited by things and gone bang over here and wallop over there. Have you noticed if there's anything that's been a common thread about what matters about the choices you've made when you've thought about those next experiences?
Yeah, yes. I think I always want to be doing something that makes me feel a sense of wonder and that I have passion for. And because of that, I think I probably could have made more money than I have. I mean, I do all right.
If your boss is listening,
we'll put
a pregnant pause on that one.
pregnant pause and bread and water for dinner tonight, boss. you know, I've sort of but by not following a linear path, I think it's harder, because you have to start again a lot of the time. And when you start again, you know, that comes with a whole sort of gamut of challenges and things you have to do to get off the ground in that particular field. Although I'm lucky, because there's been quite a lot of crossover. Well, maybe it's not luck, maybe it's just kind of worked out that way. But I've been able to use, for example, my film skills throughout my career. So when I went to World Wildlife Fund, one of the first projects I was working on was Earth Hour, which is still a really successful and one of the world's major environmental movements. And this particular year was sort of tasked with running the biggest Earth Hour on the planet, and it was based out of Singapore. And it happened to coincide with the release of Spider-Man 2. So what we did was we collaborated with a major Hollywood studio to bring a sort of mass appeal to the environment without doing it in a cheesy sense. It was actually a really, really rewarding partnership. One to this day, actually, I still have very good friends from that project that we, you know, I visit when I'm in LA and things like that. I can't remember where I was going. Oh, the crossover. So there was that film kind of tie-in already. And I was like, oh, here I am back again in the film business, you know, and to this day at Spartan, you know, I'm very involved and have been very involved over my career at Spartan in the film production side of things and broadcast media. And so there is a big crossover, but it's the passion mainly that I seek. And when
do you think that passion is what is behind the crossover, where you've got these connections between the different things? You're speaking almost as though it's coincidental that you've had those connections, but actually I wonder whether, because you're following your passion, and if filmmaking is part of that passion or creativity or however you describe it, like that's leading to these connections that naturally are then building one on top of the other to a pinball life story that's all interconnected.
Right. Yeah, right. I think that's exactly, that's a good analysis. Yeah, probably one I've never identified that clearly, that it was that way. I should probably be a little bit more introspective on it because it's interesting. But yeah, it wasn't like after my time, full time in the film business and TV business, that I suddenly hated it and it's not my passion anymore. I turn it off. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's a much more sort of dynamic flow where I think you reach points in your career where you seek new experiences. Certainly in my personality, I mean, I have fun doing personality quizzes. The Big Five is a good one. The Full Test, I think it's like 500 questions, right? I'd very much recommend that to everybody listening if you haven't done it. Yeah. You can do it online. So 500 questions. And you learn so much about yourself. And definitely seeking adventure, novelty is in my personality. So
pretty high on openness to experience, I imagine.
Yeah, quite high. Yeah. I think it was 11 out of 10. Yeah.
By the way, just a quick pop quiz. I was just thinking about your journey and WWF. There's an interesting trivia fact about WWF. Do you know that the logo misrepresents what WWF actually does? Have you come across
I remember
that?
This discussion from the day. I have come across it, but I must have cleared it from the memory bank. Tell me again.
Yeah. It's the giant panda that's on the WWF logo is one of the few animals that WWF doesn't actually look after.
Doesn't look after, right. Yeah, I remember that now.
Oh, really?
And I think at the time, that might have changed. I remember at the time we had a book, and there were many of these books around the office, and it was a book about giant pandas, and it was written by a couple of scientists who WWF had commissioned to write the book, I think. So somebody had probably come along and told them this, and then great panic ensued, and a book was published.
are involved some way. Yeah, it's the Chinese government looks after them.
The Chinese government has such a and still do, and they have such a fantastic program in Sichuan province. If you've ever been to Sichuan, there's the panda breeding center there, and you know the laws around protection of that animal in China are absolutely severe. You don't want to be caught trapping one of those things, and yeah, it's not a good ending.
No.
So yes, they're quite capable.
Yeah, just there's one thing that keeps coming up, which I don't know whether it's related to this, but location. Geographical locations. You've mentioned LA, China. You've been in China. You studied in China. You've done events in Singapore. You're not from there originally. You travel the world. How much does location play a part in how you think about your journey, like literally your metaphysical journey, and how you and what you want to do is to make a difference?
That's a great question. From personal experience, I think it makes a, it has a great impact. So I was living in, I grew up in Melbourne in Australia. I actually grew up in the countryside, but my parents took me out of a small town at about the age of eight, I think, because they were concerned that kind of growing up and, you know, doing circle work in a, we call them utes, the, you know, pickup trucks and, you know, maybe firing bow and arrows around the place. There's nothing wrong with that, but only doing that, I think they probably wanted a little bit more. So they took me down to the Big Smoke, which, you know, Melbourne, I guess you could classify that as Big Smoke by Australian standards. It's certainly not Manila or New York or London, but it's a very vibrant place. So, yeah, you know, I spent a lot of time there growing up and went to school there and so on. And then, you know, it was always in my mind that I wanted to live somewhere else. And, you know, when I was a kid, I'd draw pictures of the Great Wall. And I don't know why I would do this. And I'd draw these made-up Chinese characters. And then eventually, you know, Chinese culture became a great part of my life. I met my wife when I was 13. And she's Australian, but she's Chinese background. So it was very strange that this kind of Chinese culture came into my life. And then this desire to sort of get out of Australia became stronger and stronger. And you know, I'd sit in my, I moved into an apartment in the middle of the city, and I was working on film at the time. And, you know, I'd listen to Chinese Radio International, and I'd, you know, go out and I'd eat. I was just determined to sort of live in a different place. So eventually made it to Singapore and based ourselves here. At the time I was running a company in China, ended up moving up there, spending time apart from my wife for 2.5 years in Beijing. And all these different moves, going back to your question about the impact, had a great influence on my thinking, because it exposed me to very, very different scenarios every day, culturally, logistically. You know, when you live in Beijing, at least at the time, I was notified once, I remember, that they were turning the, or the heating wouldn't be coming on for another 2 weeks. And at that point, I think it was at least, you know, -5 Celsius, maybe -10. The winter had come pretty early that year in Beijing. And I remember the government just said, well, that is when the heating's coming on, and that's when you'll get warm. Wow. You know, and that's just pretty different to Melbourne. Wow. You know, so it was, and you know, it's not like all these experiences for me were really smooth experiences. Like, I really struggled. You know, I was an angry, fairly angry expat, let's call it. I was, you know, in my days living there. And that said, I mean, I'm very connected to the culture. So I'd like to think that I've changed. But I think that the places I've lived have given me different perspectives and definitely given me different challenges. And I don't think I would have the same mindset, global mindset, if I hadn't done it. Now, that's not to say you can't have a global mindset if you've just lived in one place. For example, I've met villagers in Yunnan province in the, you know, near Tibet, in the middle of nowhere. And they had a very interesting global mindset, but I think that came more from the stories that they handed down through the culture and their understanding of the universe and their sort of philosophical and religious understanding of the ways of things, you know, so they gained it that way. Yeah.
That's really fascinating. Thank you.
Mm.
I'm interested. If you think about a lot of the people that we speak to on this podcast, in terms of the listeners and that what we call the golden age of leadership between 25 to 40, and often they're in corporate jobs, and some of them will be absolutely thriving, and some of them will be looking at themselves in the mirror saying, you know, is this it? Is this how it's going to be for the rest of my career? And there are a handful of people out there, not many, who have taken a different path of jumping into things like you have. And I'm wondering, is there anything that you can pinpoint that made it safe for you to kind of step out on that kind of adventure and take that leap, and like that stopped you getting stuck in the thing that you weren't passionate about?
Yeah. I think the understanding of the concept of safety would be the first. You know, I have a young boy, he's 7, and he said to me the other day, we had a problem we were facing some kind of problem. And he said to me, "Daddy, is everything going to be okay?" I said, "I don't know." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "I don't know if everything's going to be okay." And then, it's a terrible thing to say as a parent. Of course, we need to give our kids, especially of that age, some confidence. But then I said to him, "Look, I can't just make up that it's going to be okay. But if you believe that whatever happens, we'll do our very best to stay together and we'll do our very best to attack a problem, it doesn't matter." He goes, "You're right." And he kind of wandered off and played Lego or something. And I think I've taken that approach. You know, I think it's less about the safety of things and more about how do you take a mindset to risk and the emotions that come with a risk and suffering and challenges. Because, you know, there's a sort of a quote I like to, well, it's not really a quote because I wrote it, but it goes something like, if you can accept the fact that there's no inherent meaning to our existence, it's very liberating. And from that point, it opens up all sorts of opportunities. For example, if someone listening right now, I mean, we have practical, before we say, well, there are practical concerns, of course, you know, we all have bills to pay and across the spectrum of income levels, you know, like billionaires I meet have bills to pay. Usually they're bigger bills, but they're still bills to pay. And yeah, sure, there's some levels of, you know, freedom that come with financial independence. It's fine. We can go into that discussion, but let's broadly say that, you know, everybody has obligations and there are implications to making changes. But I think that if we're able to step back and say, well, is there somebody standing over my shoulder with a clipboard and saying, you know, Derry, Jamie, I'm judging every single move you're making. And if you change jobs or if you decide to pursue this or if you stay in your job because you like it or if you feel comfortable and that's what you want to be is comfortable, like is good, bad or other, that doesn't exist. There's nobody doing that. The only person holding the clipboard is ourselves. So for me, for some reason, that was an inherent understanding. I don't know what psychologists could probably work with me on this. Maybe it has something to do with the fact that my parents gave me a great sense of confidence and comfort in doing these things.
Yeah.
But you know, you don't have to have that to be able to do it. You know, I think so much of what influences my decision making, not only around leadership, but around the business of life or the journey that we're on here, comes from some pretty fundamental principles that were, we think, written somewhere like 2,400 years ago during the Warring States period of China. So I'm a big fan of Tao philosophy, which of course grew into Zen philosophy. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, the Brahmins came over and the Buddhists and the Taoists got together, and then, you know, some Chinese went over to Japan and they taught Chan and they turned to Zen. And so I try to go back to these ancient philosophies and use those to guide me, and definitely within Tao philosophy, we come across concepts around the way that we deal with negative emotions, and I think fear would be one of those. Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. Yeah,
you've given me a nice segue into something which, although I think I'd be terrified, also is extremely exciting. Something else that you're just about to get involved with. And the idea of fear perhaps being a part of this for people who might take part in it. Tell us about OffMap. This is something that you're about to get involved in, you're just about to launch, but I'm interested. Tell us a little bit about it, and then really, for me, why this and why now?
Right. OffMap is it's basically taking leaders to the most remote and extreme places on earth and spending 3 days or so in the field completing a series of life-changing missions. I was luckier that through my career so far at Spartan, I've been able to do some incredible things. And from there, I was able to take people to some incredible and very remote places on Earth. And I designed about 10 of these expeditions. And I saw just the profound level of change in people. People to this day, you know, email me or text me or get in touch somehow and tell me, well, this changed my life and this particular experience changed my life. And I thought, this is great, but what would happen if we take already accomplished leaders, people either on the cusp of the next step of leadership, like so many of the people listening, or even beyond that, really experienced, like professor level, perhaps, CEOs, high net worth individuals, people that have maybe managed 10,000, 50,000 people. What happens if we take them out? Then what? And how do we take what I've learned over the years and instill that into something that's even more refined in the sense of the challenges it presents and the philosophies that we unpack and the sort of framework of the whole thing. So OffMap's tagline is navigate within. And I think that that's one of the most important things we can do. And why now is because it's interesting. You know, there's this article, I think it's a McKinsey article, about the state of leadership these days. I think it's a 2022 article. So it's fairly recent. So it's talking about the paradigm shift in leadership. You know, it's much more about servitude, I think they call it, servant leadership. They go, don't worry about the term servant. You know, everybody gets upset about that term, apparently. But they said, don't worry about that. It's about serving the people around you. Okay. And I thought that was really interesting because whilst that's a simple concept, I think that when you're trying to impart these principles through workshops in the workplace or even taking people out of the workplace and try and teach someone to become a serving leader, it's pretty difficult because first they've got to grasp totally different forms of behavior. I mean, and there's plenty of information about, you know, the hundreds of billions of dollars that's spent around the world every year on leadership training. And, you know, bring these principles back, even these new principles, and trying to effect change in an organization that's already running at 100 miles an hour in one direction is very difficult, you know, in a physics sense. You know, it's got high velocity, you know, and then trying to effect change that way is very difficult. So in my view, it requires a leader to step out and have great introspection. And that becomes really difficult with textbooks and classrooms and even workshops within the setting of your own expertise. I think the best way to do that is actually to be on the side of a mountain in Tibet with no food and water in the middle of the night in a snowstorm with a job to do to get across to the next valley to get to a monastery where there's a map to tell you where to get your food. Not only is it a hell of a lot of fun, but it puts you in these circumstances where you can be in a lab-like environment. I like to call it a lab. It's like a human laboratory where you can do these experiments and you're with other people because OffMap is team-based. You're with a very small group. Like the expeditions are very small. So this year we're headed to Tanzania towards the end of the year. It's a very small group, about 12 people. It's just three groups. And you're sort of forced to work with other humans in really dire situations. And it's hard to mirror that level of pressure in a work setting. So that's why OffMap right now. I think that more than ever, we're in an environment of great distraction and that we have great conflicting forces on us in terms of the way that we're exposed to information and, you know, sort of TikTok wisdom, and everybody wants to achieve something and I want to know the three steps to get there. And unfortunately, the, you know, systems of the universe don't work like that. So, you know, OffMap is a collection of teaching ancient wisdom and combining science and philosophy and modern day experience all in one package of adventure for experienced people.
I think you've sold me at it. I think I might have to redefine my definition of fun. The idea of being stuck on a mountain with no food, thinking I've got to get across to another mountain where there's a map of food, that doesn't sit next to fun in my dictionary, but exciting.
It definitely does in mine. It sounds amazing.
Yeah, there you go.
It does sound amazing. Who's going to be involved in this kind of thing?
In terms of who comes along?
Well, who comes along, but who? I mean, how do you manage something like that sort of experience? Yeah.
It's tough, you know. The logistics behind these things are really difficult. You know, we're able to sort of refine this over the years with Spartan, which has been great. Off maps a little different because it involves a much smaller group of people and the sort of focus on navigating within for each of the students. I like to call them students because I think we're on a lifelong journey, no matter who we are. It's, you know, there's a lot there. There's a lot of responsibility on our part. So, you know, I have a really great team of global coaches that come with me. A lot of military veterans, usually special operators that have, you know, worked in really, really difficult environments. I have one of the world's leading archaeologists. He's a British guy called William Lindsay. He actually ran along the Great Wall in 1987, the first foreigner, we believe, to run along the length of the Great Wall. He's now one of the world's leading experts on the Great Wall. He's with us. You know, I have scientists and medical professionals and a really interesting group of people who are coaches that come out with us and interact with the students on these missions, because the expeditions themselves have a start and finish, but it's kind of punctuated by sort of mission-based objectives. But it's not kind of like now you do A, now you do B, now you do C. You know, through a lot of experimentation over the years, we've sort of figured out that you put people into an environment where you throw quite a lot of variables into the mix. And that's exactly what we face every day at work. You know, even if you're, you know, putting items in a box and taping it up, you know, maybe there's slightly less variables there, but there's still quite a few. Maybe the colleagues you work with, for example, sitting around you could be highly negative. Maybe, you know, your lunch break's too short. I mean, we go out into terms of leadership of who we're, you know, the audience we're talking to here. I mean, we face so many variables every day. And in off map, we like to take these missions and add all these different variables and see sort of how it plays out. So there's a great organic component to this. And that also requires a lot of very close management because, you know, when you're in really, really remote places in very difficult conditions, you know, we've got to make sure someone doesn't get trampled by an elephant if we're in Africa, or, you know, fall off a serac if we're in the mountains, and, or, you know, die of heat exhaustion in the desert. And, you know, we operate over a very, very wide expanse, you know, hundreds of square kilometers most of the time. So it's quite the logistics experience.
Wow. It sounds like you've got a pretty big staff team there to support the students as well. And I'm hearing you talk a lot about the kind of physical safety there. There's a loose parallel for me with some of the work I do with an organization called the Mankind Project, which is a modern male initiation weekend that's been running since the 80s, kind of knocking on 100,000 people globally have been through it now. That's 48 hours. We go to wilderness, not quite the way you're talking about, but wilderness, you know, in the UK or various countries, get people off grid, etc. One of the really important things that enables the transformation that people go on that weekend is what we call the staff container, which is the strength and tightness of the staff group, so that the men that are there can push against that container when they need to, go to some really deep, dark part of themselves to understand something new, learn something new, transform who they are. There's got to be the walls for them to push against. And I can imagine in the environments that you're talking about, the stress and the tension and the hunger and whatever else is going on, the physical tiredness could result in a lot of conflict and a lot of clashing. And how do you kind of think about making it like there's enough of a container that people can not just explode and go off the rails, and that they actually get the journey and then that navigate within progress that you're trying to get them to?
Yeah. In other words, how do we not let the whole thing turn into Lord of the Flies or something like that?
Yeah, basically. That yeah.
Sometimes it does, but that's okay. over the years, you know, with Spartan, it was interesting. Yeah, you know, we had a much bigger group on the expeditions, and we sort of started off a certain way, and we refined it, and I'd sit down and I'd take a blank bit of paper out every time I'd do this, and I'd start from scratch again and try and refine the model. At Spartan, we didn't have the ratio of coaches to students, I think, that is ideal. It was great, and it is great. But with off-map, you know, the ratio, there are more coaches there usually than students. At least they're not all interacting with students as coaches. There's a lot of operational stuff going on. So the level of interaction definitely helps guide things. But then in terms of meltdowns and complete shit shows, we'll definitely let that happen. In fact, I've noticed a pattern. You get a group of people together. Some of them might know each other. Let's say most of them don't. And you put them together in a very difficult situation where they have to problem solve, let's call it problem solve or die. If they were going to actually die, we would step in. But, you know, ostensibly they've got to solve a problem and a series of problems that kind of permeate out of that main problem, which is, in this case, it could be, hey, I was blindfolded in the middle of the savannah in Africa. Take my blindfold off, I've got nothing. My backpack's gone. I've got no water. I've got no food. Now what do? I look around and there's, you know, 11 other people. What I've noticed is within the first day or so, it does turn into Lord of the Flies. People aren't working together. There's sometimes somebody might step up and they take the role of quote unquote leader. That may last, that may not. It depends on the person, it depends on the group. And it depends on lots of things. The environment, you know, how that person is able to kind of shepherd these people through, if that's the case. But basically, I've never seen a group of humans get together and operate in extreme efficiency from the get-go, no matter how experienced. Now, I'm talking leadership coaches, high-level people, doesn't matter. It's an absolute mess. And so we do let it degrade. With Spartan, we were out in the empty quarter desert, the biggest sand desert, biggest sand dunes in the world and the biggest sand desert in the world. It's in Abu Dhabi area of UAE, and it expands out in towards Oman, and it goes all the way down to Saudi Arabia. This place is massive. And these sand dunes are like 200 or 300 meters high. So getting around is really difficult. And I remember one night, it was 2 a.m., I look across and I see one team. And they've literally given up. I'm talking like 15 people. These groups were bigger with Spartan. 15 people sitting down with their heads in their hands. And I went over and I said, what are you doing? And they're like, basically, there's no point. Like that. It wasn't that we give up even. It was just, I don't think they even knew that they'd given up. They just were out of ideas. They were out of energy and they'd just given up. And, you know, so like not quite Lord of the Flies, but, you know, in some ways as extreme, because these people are just kind of thrown in the towel, and that's common, you know. And then of course you get all sorts of conflict. You get decisions that are insane, you know, like let's head over this mountain in this direction and just keep going. And, you know, eventually we'll intervene. Like this actually happened in Africa. The team headed off and like it was like 800 kilometers of nothing in that direction. And it's completely the opposite direction where they needed to go. And if they'd stopped and thought about it and talked and used a few basic principles, and you don't need to be a survival expert to come up with these principles. It's kind of like maybe we'll get up high and take a look around and figure out that there's a road. And they knew that there was a road there. But they shun the road. We're going to just head cross country over this mountain into the distance. And so, you know, we eventually sent someone out on a motorbike with a shotgun. And he was a quote unquote angry farmer that turned the team around. But we let him go for a while. So, you know, in a fairly long and colorful answer, you know, I think you've got to let the lab play out. And I think that's something that we find very difficult to do as coaches. I don't mean in the off-map sense. I mean, all of us on the call, you know, we have teams, we have people we look after, we teach leadership. It's very difficult to get people into that element where you can let all of the good, bad, and ugly out so that people can really examine, okay, who am I as a leader? What is my understanding of the world I live in? And how does that affect my actions? And I think that that's something that is very difficult to capture in a textbook when teaching leadership, because, you know, we see some, you know, the top consulting firms, from McKinsey's and so on, talking about, okay, well, we need to teach leaders to be introspective. How do you teach someone to be introspective? It's very rare the person that picks up a copy of the, you know, Tao Te Ching, you know, the ancient Chinese philosophical text, and reads it and goes, bing, I now understand myself and the universe I live in. I'm ready to lead, you know.
Yeah.
I think we have to take a much more systems mindset. You know, I studied systems, systems analysis and systems thinking. And it's a very difficult topic to study, because it's very difficult to draw a system, even if it's very simple, because you start to lay out all the different variables and it becomes really, really complex. I mean, look, that's just the way the universe works. I mean, we can talk about complex systems, you know, like interplanetary systems, for example, or something like that. Or we can talk about, you know, physics, biology, great examples. That's why I think the sciences and philosophy are so important for leaders. But, you know, being introspective, okay, that's one thing, but also understanding how that person fits into the greater system of things. You know, ants are really good at this. but I think sport's a really good example, just to be more practical. You guys are in the UK, so we can talk football. I mean, okay, there's 11 men or women on the pitch. You know, I think we could argue that the best teams are, at any one time, one of those 11 players, and maybe the people coming in, you know, as subs, can step up as a leader. Anybody with a ball is really in a position of leadership at any point of time, right? Including the goalkeeper. And I think that that's a great example of human efficiency and leadership working the way that, you know, the rest of the universe works. When you're a leader, sometimes you've got the ball, sometimes you don't. But really, really efficient teams, and it seems that in sports is a great example. I think elite military context is probably another example where, you know, it's not necessarily the old vision of leadership. Sure, sometimes we have these needs in modern business that we have to take a leadership position and provide the answers. And sometimes providing the answers, the team hasn't got a clue, and you need to provide those answers. That's fine. But sometimes we need to work as a system. There's a lot there, hey?
Oh, there is. I'm really struck by something there, which is, you know, that moment where I think you take people to the edge and they see themselves differently. They see themselves in their context, in their system differently, because of how far they've been pushed out of the patterns they've been normally comfortable with.
I think, exactly. Jamie, I'd even build on that and say you have to get to the edge in order to see yourself differently, really. Like, to your point, Dave, you can read the theory, you can do a big five personality profile, you can develop a level of introspection and self-awareness, but until you actually test yourself in a challenging environment, you don't really know how true that is, how you're going to react.
Exactly. And I think that we're prey to Instagram wisdom around this a lot these days, meaning there's so much out there where it's like, we're going to transform you. You're going to transform. You're going to, that word's used a lot. You know, you're going to look within and change. You know, what does that even mean? You know, I think this is not, to pushing yourself to the edge isn't as simple as, you know, going through something difficult. I that's one, that's okay. I mean, at Spartan, we do that on a mass level with the events, and it's fantastic. But let's move another level or few up when we're talking leadership. I believe that when we're talking at an advanced level here, pushing to the edge in and of itself isn't enough. We have to, as we do that, we have to understand why. We have to understand context. So as we're on the edge, the context of everything going on around us and our sort of role in the system of things, that level of thinking takes our understanding of leadership to a whole new level, because I believe there are many and very talented people out there that do really hard things. Athletes that I've worked with do incredible things. But if I were to examine some of these people and say, would they make a great leader, even though they push themselves to the edge all the time? And I'd say, no, not all of them make great leaders. So it's not just about pushing to the edge. It's about pushing to the edge and then, or simultaneously, asking the questions and creating some introspective awareness and external awareness of your sort of role in things. And there's a lot there.
Yeah,
I like that articulation of like a leader as part of a system. Because it's very easy to put the leader at the top. Say, oh, you're the leader.
We're told that so much, aren't we?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we see it. We see Churchill. There's so many great leaders, for us to draw inspiration from. I do too. But I think we have to ask ourselves, okay, that's an example of someone who's engaged in a form of leadership. Well, let's use Churchill. I mean, he was engaged in a form of leadership during the war period as a leader of a nation, and allied forces fighting an enemy. That's one form of leadership. But, my kid was home from school today because he was sick. He turned on the TV and he's watching animations of planets and how planets interact with each other and how gravity works at a planetary level. I'd say that's a fantastic example of leadership. There's that classic example. It was probably fake. Remember, the story about Kennedy when he visited NASA and he meets the janitor, and the janitor, he says, "What are you doing?" And the janitor says, "I'm putting a man on the moon is what I'm doing." I mean, that's a good story, whether it's real or not. NASA kind of understood it. They needed everybody engaged in this system of leadership. So I think leadership as a term, and our to your point, Derry, it's we tend to view leaders as the person behind the pulpit or the CEO, the division leader, where's the quarterback, whereas I don't really see it that way. That's one form, sure.
A quote comes to mind. We talked about quotes earlier on, the one that you wrote, but there's a quote that comes to mind about off map actually. Have you ever read the quote? Is the quote from Marcel Proust, which is the real voyage of discovery lies not in seeking new landscapes, but in having new eyes.
Right.
I think off map is taking Marcel Proust and giving it a boost.
Saying, yes. Yeah.
Put you in a new landscape, put you on the edge, and that's a way of finding those new eyes.
Absolutely. That's a fantastic way to say it. And it's simultaneous, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is taking you to the next level. It is putting you in a new landscape with the new eyes. And it's an interactive. It's an interactive thing. Sorry, go on, Jamie. Yeah. You were going to say something.
Well, I just think it's stunning. I mean, it's kind of slightly stretching my mind even just thinking about the experiences that people will be going on with you.
Right.
And I'm assuming, therefore, off map is open for business.
It's open for business. Yeah, we're headed to Tanzania October 17th. So, it's very niche thing, you know. It's certainly not for everybody. And yeah, that point sort of addresses what we were just talking about. Getting these new eyes and off-map being a method. I think over the course of history, we've searched, we being, you know, humanity, we've searched for ways to improve ourselves or unlock questions in the universe or, you know, understand things better. Even just like when we're suffering, why is this happening to me? You know, you say, I mean, many adults say that. Many kids definitely say that. You know, why did this happen to me? And you know, we're dealing with emotions of negativity, anger, jealousy, fear. So over the course of humanity, there's a lot of ancient wisdom that deals with this stuff. And OffMap takes ancient wisdom and puts it in a modern context. So that's the great thing. Like if we go out and we're with, for example, in Tanzania, we'll be with the Hadzabe, the Hadza tribe, one of the last tribes to live in a very traditional way. And this area in Tanzania is very, very wild and remote. I mean, it's people jump on the car there for a lift and they get on with their bow and arrow, you know. yeah, it's really different out there. So OffMap does that by taking ancient wisdom and infusing it into this kind of modern context of exploration. But I think there are other incredible ways that humans have figured this stuff out as well. Some civilizations engaged in plant medicine. You know, ayahuasca is talked about a lot. I think when we start getting into psychedelics and things like that, you know, it can get a, some people have a, maybe a, not the full understanding there. And, you know, psilocybin, for example, you know, treated as a party drug, whereas psilocybin, you know, of course we've heard about the stoned ape theory and whether that's true or not, whether our ancestors, you know, ate mushrooms and their brains evolved, we don't know yet. But certainly that psilocybin, for example, and mushrooms have been used for thousands of years for that purpose. And so OffMap is another catalyst, let's call it, you know. Yeah, plant medicine was one. Meditation is another, a little bit more esoteric. And I think that meditation tends to be associated with Eastern philosophy, Eastern in the sense of, you know, Hinduism or Zen or Tao, or various forms of Buddhism, you know, Theravada, Mahayana Buddhism. And, you know, it gets pretty complicated. So I think the barrier to entry, let's say, for a person engaging in meditation is pretty high. And then, okay, well, let's say we take another form of ancient wisdom, plant medicine. A lot of people have helped get, you know, have had great leaps of understanding through that. I mean, one of my guys, very, very experienced warfighter and also contractor, you know, British Royal Marine commander, you know, suffered considerable PTSD. And I know that his journey has been helped considerably with psilocybin, but also meditation and also expeditions with me, you know. So I think the point I'm trying to make is that OffMap is, I think it's quite unique now, but I think that it's just it's another form of exploration into understanding who are we, what is this all about, if anything. And if it's nothing, which I think it is, then what? And, you know, then we can get to that point. Yeah, then what? Yeah, and, you know, and then we get to that point and then we can, I think when we can start asking these sorts of questions, we're ready to work within a system of a higher plane of understanding. Well, that's not woo-woo. I mean, that's like evolved organizations. We could put that into organizational leadership theory. I mean, remember the old five-stage tribal stages? You guys remember that like 15 years ago? I think that was a little bit simplistic. If everybody doesn't know about that, you can check it out. There was a book written about the tribal stages of an organization. You know, stage one was meant to be something like, you know, you walk around and you get a screwdriver and you shove it in the back of someone's head. And stage five was, you know, you're all existing for something bigger. But I think, you know, I think that oversimplifies it all as well. You know, I mean, in a prison, there are many people showing leadership, you know, and it's not that simple. It's very difficult to put things into rules and definitions. I mean, that's why Taoism kind of arose in the ancient times. There was Confucianism, which sort of ended up being the guiding path for China, but which was very rule-based, wasn't it? But yeah, so I think as a leader, you need to start thinking about these things, and you can integrate into a bigger system.
Yeah.
So many themes there that we cover off a lot. Unfortunately, we're gonna have to wrap this one up, Dave. But I'd love to have you back after your October 17th Tanzania trip and hear how that's gone. That would be fascinating if you're up for that.
I would love to.
Where can people find OneMap in our digital world?
Yeah. So if you want to check out OffMap, you can go to offmap.online.
Offmap.online.
It's a very simple website, because very much we're very much in the mindset of tangible physical things. So we have a beautiful book that we're happy to send to people if they're serious about doing this. You know, it's not a cheap endeavor, you know, you can get a copy of the book through the website. And if you have questions, you can feel free to drop them in there. If you want to talk about leadership or you have some ideas, you know, always glad to have those discussions for sure.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. We are, the way that we work, we'll have a little debrief conversation with Graham, who's been listening in.
Yes.
And reflections.
Great.
But thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's been absolutely fascinating talking to you.
Thank you.
It's been really eye-opening, and just so much behind what's going on and your story as well. It's really inspiring. So thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's been great. Talk soon. Cheers. Bye-bye.
So then, gentlemen, your initial reactions to that?
Wow. Got my plane tickets. Wowee.
Yeah, that was really cool. I'd love to do one of the off-map experiences. And I really loved his philosophy around experiences, actually, around the importance of experiences to really get to know who you are as a leader. That was really cool.
Yeah.
Say more about WOW, Jamie.
Well, WOW, just in terms of the ambition and the endeavor, and just what an experience that's going to be for the people who take part, not just of the people who are, as he describes them, the students, but the faculty, the logistics organizers. Anytime we run any kind of event, you guys have run as many as I have, everybody gets something out of it. But you know, a small group like that in such a challenging environment, where it's not just about getting the task done, but helping people to find those new eyes, all at the same time. That's a wow for me. That's right at the very, very edge of all of the kind of stuff that we've been talking about over the last two, nearly three seasons, packaged into something which will be life-changing and an extraordinary life memory for anybody. That's the wow.
I'm really interested. There were two standout phrases that I thought were really sort of came up with. One was the role of sort of systems thinking. And we've not really, I don't feel like we've really touched that on any of the episodes yet in great detail. We might have skirted it, but we've never gone deep into that. And this idea of variable management. I wondered what thoughts that brought up for you both as you were sort of listening to and hearing from Dave.
I think the systems thinking one for me is, it's a real sort of next level on this concept of servant leader. Where I think it's easy for a leader to put themselves above or below the team. So above is the sort of traditional view of being a leader, and below is this servant leader where I don't matter, everything is in service of the team. And actually, the way that he's talking about it is the complexity of leadership is that every person in a team has elements of leadership that they need to bring forward at different moments, at micro moments and big moments, and that the team as a system needs to work well together. And the concept of leadership within that framework is completely different, really. It doesn't really matter what your job title is. And then understanding how that all can interface based on who you are and how you react to stuff and your emotional state and your knowledge and your experience, et cetera, is super complicated. What about you, Jamie?
Systems thinking, I have to admit, I've, from a very early part of my professional career, not realizing what I was being exposed to, I was exposed to systems thinking and some techniques and tools about it, thinking that that's how everybody did it. So I now find myself, when I hear about people talking about the need to introduce it, the need to teach it, I find it's almost difficult to step outside it and see it any other way than the way my mind works. So I recognize how important it is in terms of how I go about what I do. But I wouldn't actually, I actually don't even know how I would go about teaching it in some respects. But I think the kind of thing that Dave was talking about there, and indeed some of the mankind experiences you told us about, where you're put into an experience, and the fact that you've got a container through which you can then start to get other perspectives about yourself, about this, about the environment, the context, means that you're kind of axiomatically, you are starting to understand the moving parts, the variables in a system, without it being called systems thinking. You're just exposed to it. And I think that's the experiential side of what he's describing there, and the experiential side of development, I think, is something that's massively undervalued even now, even though it's been proven that it's a much more effective way of helping developmental progress to be made. Yeah. When it's handled in the right way, with that kind of reflective feedback, support, assistance, and a container that's safe. This is a different kind of safe. Talking about redefining safe in yeah. that you don't fall off the mountain, maybe not, but we will send out the Jeep with the guy in a shotgun just to make sure you turn around. Yeah, it's on the edges of definitions of safe. So I think that systems thinking element, I think, is really, really vital. Graham, what was the other?
Well, that I was just going to say on that, like, I got exposed to group dynamics and system thinking through my master's degree. And since I got exposed to it, it's life changing. And it's often how I think of circumstances I'm in. I've also, you know, qualified and trained as a practitioner of constellations, which was a great vehicle for enabling people to somatically feel what's taking place in the system and then start to influence it and start to shift it from that position in the system. And I've loved the way that you talk about it there, Derry, this idea that there are moments in a system where you are required to lead, but you may not necessarily be the leader. And I think in today's working world, where, you know, socialized responsibility for an outcome is more present than ever, the appreciation that you are going to have to lean in at times in a way to take something forwards, because that's what the system's asking you to do. People's ability to be able to tap into that, I think, is going to be one of the most critical skills needed in the near future, if not today. So,
well, one of the things that just came up for me there when you were talking, Graham, is I think there's a risk around that as well, because I see a risk of groupthink, essentially. If you're in a system and everybody is being a leader at different moments, and that peer responsibility that you reference, which I think is true, if everybody's responsible, nobody's responsible, right? And then you can end up saying, well, as a group, we all decided to move in this direction. And it could be hard in that environment for differential opinions and differential perspectives and controversial thoughts to come out. So as a leader within that system, making it safe for those controversial thoughts to come out is, I think, really critical.
Oh, for sure. And that's, you, it's almost like a team's got to say who's going to be with the motorbike and the shotgun.
Yeah.
And yeah, be an angry farmer.
Who's the angry farmer?
Who's like the angry farmer? There we go. I think we're putting it all into our next workshops.
Yeah. That's the name of a podcast series. Who's the angry farmer?
The spin-off that we created, you know. And you're right, Derry. I think you're right. And there's only an article going around today, actually, from the FT. It's about quit talkers. Go and have a look at it.
Quit talkers.
Quit talkers.
People quitting on TikTok and then.
Oh, just go and look into it. It's a whole nother podcast. I assure you, it's a whole nother podcast.
Right.
But it emphasizes the need of the presence of groupthink in today's society. And it raises for me the question, who is just checking groupthink?
Yeah.
For sure. Because it can lead to, we've seen it, the evidence has been there for years, groupthink, short-sightedness, very present in terms of the impact that you want to have. But has it got any air of the tail of that impact? Who knows? You know, all that stuff kind of comes up. So for me, yeah, you bang on, buddy. You bang on. So
the other piece that jumped out for me was early on in the conversation when we're talking about like the path that he's taken to bounce from his passions, things that he's energized by, et cetera, et cetera. And that image that he portrayed of, you know, you don't have somebody stood on your shoulder with a clipboard checking everything that you're doing. Or actually you do, but it's you. It's not some other person. The phrase that came to mind to me there was, you'd care a lot less about what other people thought about you if you realized how little they do. And I just want to really encourage people to step through the fear of following your passion in some way. Because for the vast majority of people, it'll be all right in the end. And you'll regret not doing it way more than regretting doing it.
Yeah, hear, hear to that.
Yeah, passion was one of the words that just made me think it runs through everything. You can't do what he does, you can't do what he's done without there being a, do I have passion for this? So I think that's the one big takeaway. Yeah, take a look in the mirror. If you've listened to this podcast, have a look in the mirror and go, am I passionate about what I'm doing? Do I get another chance to do this?
And listeners, one day we will all be told that Jamie has decided to take up the long, passioned career of a geography teacher. Because he's sporting a waistcoat today, and it always makes me think of
that. Is that saying, isn't it? If you visualize it and manifest it, it will come true.
Hmm. Maybe that's another episode in itself as well, because I'd love to talk about manifestation. Maybe
Jamie's manifestation of geography teacher.
Yeah, but how? But I'd love to talk about how it's spoken about, but how little is actually spent. And Dave referenced it as well, that there's levels beyond what you speak about making happen. And it's allowing for those and creating the conditions for those to take place that I think is just completely lost. Oh, I manifested that outcome.
Yeah.
There's a lot there.
So I'd love to speak to Dave again after Off Map October 2024 is complete, and just
maybe you can do a double interview, because I'm going to be there too. So
so jealous.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, we'll get you both back, Graham.
Thanks. I'm so honoured, chaps. So, but there it is.
Whoever survives is welcome back to
and welcome into the Sharp Podcast with the new host, David Watson, because Graham sadly fell by the wayside.
Well, we think he's shot by the angry farmer.
He's 700 kilometers in the wrong direction in Tanzania.
Excellent. Chaps, until the next one, have a good day.
You too.
Cheers, chaps. Goodbye, everyone.
Find any of the subjects we cover in this podcast spark inspiration, curiosity, or concern within you. do drop us a line. Details are in the comments below, and we'll be happily there to listen and see how we can offer the best support for you.